This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
We've heard a lot of stories about Brian Koberger in the last 3 years. We're hearing far more in the last 3 months than we've heard in all of those 3 years. Today, we're going to go through the 7 creepiest moments that we have newly learned about Brian Koberger's interactions with the community, with the people living out there. And if you'll excuse me, I'm going to put my earpiece in because I keep forgetting to do this. So while we go through these stories, I want to hear your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi so you can join us in this conversation. All right, let's jump into this. This is one where it gets you. It gets you for the creepiness and the level of investigative work, I guess, that was done to someone that didn't need any investigating. He could have just asked for a name. But this woman, she didn't wear a name tag. She wasn't the type to make small talk, especially not with customers who gave her that feeling. She clocked in, she poured coffee, kept her eyes down. So when Brian Koberger said her name out loud, clearly, like he'd said it before, it stopped her cold. She never gave him that, never once, but he knew it. And that's when she knew something was wrong, not just awkward or uncomfortable. Wrong in the way that made her chest tighten. She hadn't imagined the pattern. He really had been watching her. He always came in near closing time, not a morning regular, not part of the afternoon rush. No, he came in when the place had thinned out, and she was usually the only one working in front. He always ordered the same thing, never talked much, just stood there, staring, waiting. It didn't feel random, it felt deliberate. And now it made sense. After he said her name, he started asking questions about psychology, about personality disorders, about whether she thought psychotherapists could control their impulses or psychopaths could control their impulses. Weird questions to ask at the coffee counter. And weird to know, considering that area was her major. Again, another thing that she never shared with him. She tried to smile it off, but he was locked in, not flirting, studying her, gathering information like she was part of a research paper. A few days later, he came in with a woman. She didn't know who, maybe a friend. As he paid, he looked over at her and said, "See, I told you she was smart." The way he said it, not like he was paying her a compliment, more like he was proving a point, confirming something that he already knew about this good friend over here that he shouldn't have known anything about, but did, and she knew nothing about him. She started switching shifts, asking the manager if she could be moved to mornings. She didn't want to be near the front alone anymore, and she started checking the parking lot before walking to her car, too. Smart. Because when someone like that knows your name, what else do they know? And she wasn't wrong. A few months earlier in June, Koberger had checked into a small hotel in Pullman, Washington. He'd booked it through Expedia. The woman behind the front desk was training that day, new to the system. Koberger walked in alone, visibly irritated. He said there was a double charge on his credit card. Accused her of making a mistake. Said she was trying to rip him off. You know, like all hotel employees do. Let's see how we can rip off the guests today. It's more like, how can we get through this smoothly and calmly and make it home safe and alive? He said that she was trying to rip him off. His voice was flat, but very aggressive, and his eyes didn't blink much. She corrected the charge, apologize like any normal human being would do, because accidents happen. She said it'd be refunded. And that's when he changed, thankfully, or not, depending how you look at it. The anger vanished, and suddenly he was kind patient, even charming. He told her she was good at her job, asked where she was from, tried to make small talk. The shift was too fast, and that shift made her uneasy. She said it felt like he was flipping a switch, testing her reaction. The next day, she passed him in the hallway, and he stopped her. Not to say, hey, nice day. What's there to do around here? I'm new to the area. You know, things you might ask someone that works at a hotel in a friendly, non-weird way. No. In that hallway, alone, cornered, started talking about knives, sheaths, self-defense blades. He told her what kind of knives he liked, how they felt in the hand, the difference between a tactical blade and a collector's piece. You know, things you want to fill in, the hotel front desk lady as she's walking down the hall to get more syrup for the pancake bar. She nodded, smiled, and got away as fast as she could. She didn't think about it again until the mug shot. Then she couldn't stop thinking about it. At Washington State University, Koberger was earning his PhD in criminology, but in the classroom, he didn't carry himself like a student. He was dismissive, arrogant, and when female students spoke, he often interrupted them, corrected them. One student remembered him saying, "No, that's not what the data shows," mid-sentence. His tone wasn't just critical, it was belittling. Professors noticed it too. One of them reported that he was growing more erratic, that he seemed to enjoy intellectual dominance, especially over women. He was eventually warned. Later, he lost his teaching assistant position. Officially, it was for poor performance. Unofficially, it was because people were afraid of what might come next. One woman who met him on Tinder did not have to guess. She saw it up close. They matched online, and he invited her over. She said he was stiff, didn't talk much, seemed more interested in getting physical than getting to know her. Touched her leg even, scooted closer, didn't respond when she pulled away. When she stood up to leave, he didn't argue, he didn't beg, he just stared at her like she'd interrupted something. Later that night, he sent her a series of messages, not angry, just persistent, repetitive, asking why she left, asking what did he do wrong. No apology, no insight, just need. She blocked him. A neighbor in Moscow, Idaho, remembers a different kind of contact, not physical, not verbal, just sound. Tapping. Around 4 a.m, the night of the murders, he woke up, allegedly tapping at his bedroom window. Not banging, not knocking, just a light rhythmic tapping, enough to freeze him in bed. He looked out the window but saw nothing, no one, just darkness. He didn't think much of it until later when Koberger's name hit the news. When the police said they were looking for a white Hyundai Elantra, when he remembered seeing that exact car parked just down the block. For a few nights that same week, it all kind of clicked. And it hadn't clicked. It hadn't unclicked, rather, since. Earlier that year in Pullman, there was a break-in at a sorority house. A masked man entered through an unlocked door. He had a knife. He didn't take anything, didn't hurt anyone, just stood there. According to the report, no fleeing. No one caught him. No charges were filed, and the case went cold. After Koberger's arrest, investigators quietly reopened it. One woman remembered a study group session with him. He didn't say much, just watched, listened. She felt him staring. He sat across from her, eyes fixed. She asked a question, and he responded not with an answer, but with a question of his own. What do you think goes through someone's mind when they kill another person up close? She laughed, assuming he was joking. He didn't. He just kept looking at her like he was still waiting for her answer. Note, very similar question to that survey he put out for criminals that was very much focused on the feeling that one gets in the act of committing horrific crimes. He had quite the fascination with this angle. Seven people. Different cities, different contexts, but every one of them remembers that same thing. That feeling, the cold, the shift in the room when he walked in, the sense that he was reading them, not connecting with them, not flirting, not socializing, studying. He didn't want attention. He wanted control. Not all predators hide in the shadows. Some walk around in daylight holding coffee cups and making polite conversation. Some pass out syllabi. Some smile when they say your name. And sometimes by the time you realize what they are, it is too late. He wasn't shy. He was a bit awkward. He was practicing, rehearsing, control, watching how fear unfolds in real time. And everyone who crossed his path, they were the dress rehearsal. There's many other stories. Birthing hips stands out as one of them to me. What's that? Koberger went on the Tinder date. Text back afterwards, as one does after the date when you're hoping maybe there'll be a second. You have great birthing hips. Knives, procreation, and how do killers feel as they take the lives of the living off this planet? It seems to be the common rotation of topics in his mind. Tell me what your thoughts are in the comment section. Tell me about creepy encounters you've had with people in life. Maybe Koberger-ish. Have you ever had one? An encounter with someone who later turns out to be someone far worse than you knew at that moment in time? I'd love to hear your thoughts in the comments on YouTube. If you're not there already, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you'll find us there. Do that same search wherever you download podcasts to find us as well.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Oh, we have a lot to go over today. Adelson's, of course, we're going to dive into that. This is a day Donna's going to decide whether or not to testify. We'll talk about that. We'll also take a look at some testimony from a jailhouse snitch that says she almost got a grand piano out of Donna. You know, it's a little bartering that, you know, you don't expect to do in prison, but, you know, Donna's got the goods. So we'll do that. We'll take a look at Donna's best friend's testimony on the stand, which I don't know that it did a whole lot for Donna, but we'll talk about that. Also going to be talking with Jennifer Coffendaffer today about Harvey and Wendy Adelson. What sort of future might be held for them after Donna is found guilty or innocent, in the far chance that that happens. And then Siobhan Scott's going to be joining us, psychotherapist and author, and we're going to go into the world of family enmeshment, which essentially is the Adelson family. Is it good? Is it bad? Why do so many people keep coming back for more? We're going to talk about all that in the second hour of the program. But be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us or watching us so you don't miss us every day. And in the comments section, be sure to let us know your thoughts, your questions, and we'll try to get to them throughout the program today. But first, we're going to start with some new breaking news. Brian Koberger, there's a new detail that has come out that's not going to be just floating away from our radar. It's not about the crime itself, but what was happening in his private conversations right after. And when you hear it, you can't really help but ask what exactly was going on here. So the night after the murders, Brian's mother, they're talking as they have been. As you know, Brian Koberger and mom are pretty tight. They were talking the morning of the murders, right after, for several hours. And then throughout the day later, he was on the phone with her constantly while he was in jail. But this is an interesting one. The night after the murders, Brian's mother sent him a news article. It was a link. Not just any article. And I don't know how odd this is. That's why I'm curious to get everyone's reaction on it. This one spelled out how Zanna Kernodle had bruises all over her body and how she had fought back against the attacker. That's what was being alleged in that article. I mean, think about this for a second. mom sending her son a link to the story about the brutal murder may be normal. I can kind of understand that. But does it land a little differently while the two of them are already on the phone together? Obviously, she probably doesn't know that, you know, Lil Bri is the one behind it. But does it strike you as normal? Let's just start there in casual conversation that mom would be sending Brian, you know, links to this horrible crime. It did happen where he's at. So is it strange on that level? Let's start there.
Well, it's odd. Now, I say that as we have an audience of people who love true crime.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, it has to do with the area that he was in. It was a huge news story. So yeah, that could make sense. But then if you turn it on its side and go, wait a minute, that's some really unusual banter between a mom and a son, I think.
Well, it depends, I guess, on the relationship. I mean, what's unusual? If you and your mom talk about true,
if you talk about mother and, you know, like, if you're like they had a relationship.
If you're into that topic, what's weird about talking about that topic? I mean, yeah, her son turned out to be the killer, but I don't see it as being that out there. I mean, when, for example, like, so Devil's Den, that occurred here where the monster went into the woods and killed the husband and wife recently. And we were covering that quite heavily before they found the killer. You know, my mom's, you know, sending me, you know, articles about it and stuff. Wow. And I'm letting her know, sending her what I'm reporting about it. So, you know, we talk about those sort of things somewhat. We don't dive into every case. If I said Karen Reed, she'd probably have no idea what I'm talking about. But I don't know. From that dynamic, I don't know that it's that weird. But the topics I talk about sometimes with my mom and my parents, I know are kind of odd.
Yeah, but look at what you do for a living. I you are the exception. Yeah. I mean, well, but he's a criminology student. So, again,
is it odd? I don't know. I mean, look, I remember when I was a kid going into the radio station and telling Todd some of the conversations I had with my mom, and Todd would be like,
Wait, what's going on there?
And in true Todd fashion, I remember none of that. So
no, you blocked it out is what happened.
Yes. Yeah. But like, I don't know how odd that is on the surface, but that's gotta be a weird one to have to try and, you know, comb through all this time later. Yeah. You've got to be looking at everything that he said to you on those phone calls and going, you know, what does it mean? What was he saying? I mean, it gets even stranger right after that, their conversation, her texts the next morning, to him. And this is interesting. And this is all from some of the criminologists and some of the folks who were digging into the Cellbrite data. And this is what they were telling Ashley last night on Banfield on News Nation, that her messages veer into coffee beans, a line about a sweet girl working at a coffee shop, totally disconnected from the weight of what they had just been talking about. It does appear that there might be some pieces to this conversation that are missing. As we know, he was deleting things, but what we do have is her communication to him, not necessarily his out or what they had spoken of. So, I mean, it kind of leans a little bit towards, well, it looks like they had been having some sort of conversation about some girl he thought maybe was cute that worked at the coffee shop.
Well, and remember, we've talked about the barista who had a close run-in with him.
Yep.
So what part of that conversation's missing here where he's obsessing over this woman who knows nothing about him?
Yeah. And he's talking to mom about her.
Yeah. You know, you don't talk to mom about somebody unless things are cooking, I guess, you know?
Or I wouldn't think, cooking.
But we don't know the dynamic either.
Yeah, what's odd about it is that both the topics, the bruises all over the victim's body, okay, that is something that from my understanding, he might really enjoy talking about because of his what he's into. I mean, we know that about him.
Yeah.
And then the coffee part of it and the barista and all that. It's just, if you just look at it by itself, if you didn't know everything that went down in that situation, you'd be like, eh, just conversation, a little weird. But this was like, it was almost feeding him to me.
He seems to have very few modes of what he talks about and what he goes on. I mean, it's interesting as we learn more about him. He enjoys talking about knives and knife sheaths, as we know that he loved, like, just randomly talking to the woman at the hotel about that in the hallway. He likes to talk about the coffee and the girl at the coffee shop. It's very narrow obsessions that he goes on, which, you know, goes with the autism. That's a lot of thinking. You do get more narrowly focused on things, but he seems to have no way of functioning outside of it. Like, he needs somebody to trip him up and go, okay, Brian, next thing, next step, let's keep moving here. Because he really gets onto that. I'd be really curious. I'd love to know from that mom, what was that conversation like about the bruising, about the, I mean, and I hate gory details. I do not like talking about them. We don't show the pictures. We don't do any of that shit, 'cause I don't think it adds to the story. But what I am curious about is that conversation. Was he excited? Did that perk Brian up to sit there and talk about, well, I think this might have happened or that might have happened, the way that Papa Roger character came out online and said, well, I think this, and seemed to have knowledge beyond what was in the current publishings of the moment. If mom could look back and say, well, how did he know that?
Well, but don't forget too, and I'm not defending Brian Koberger. Please don't ever put me in that category. But being a criminology student, this is his arena. This is where he thrives. This is where, you know, he's studying this. So I remember in the days of, you know, when I went into radio, everything music was talked about with me, like, oh, we should talk to her about that. Or when I went into veterinary medicine, like, oh, here's this really weird case that, you know, was in the paper for some reason. Or so people gravitate toward those topics. Maybe that was just a innocuous, hey,
he's into that.
Yeah.
He's going to school for that. Let's talk about something that maybe interests him.
And again, you brought up the autism. I've been doing some reading about Temple Grandin. Very, very amazing human being. But she talks about how people on the spectrum, their thoughts aren't linear. They're just very segmented and all over the place. And to people who are not on the spectrum, it looks very odd. Incredibly odd, but to them, that's a normal.
Yeah.
So from our perspective, not being on the spectrum, it's really disconcerting to see this journey that they take to get through a topic.
Well, especially when the topics are very off, when they're like,
exactly.
If
he were not a criminology student and he went into great detail about, you know, what happened at this crime and really was digging into the details, I would be very alarmed. But he has that degree. So to me, it's like, it's just another day at the office.
What does it say, though, about, like, that his mom is the one he's turning to constantly after these horrific things? He literally just killed four people. And now if you read the tea leaves, he's talking about the cute girl at the coffee shop, which we now know he had some sort of interaction with that made her uncomfortable. It makes you wonder, you know, he's already, the fact that he's able to sit there and think about some, like, another human being in any sort of, like, maybe I'll date her sort of way after just murdering four people. It makes you wonder. I wonder how much in code he spoke to his mom. I wonder how much, you know, gazing at the stars meant something else other than it seems to mean. If he was speaking in certain ways of, you know, I got a crush on this girl, or I like this girl, is more like, I'm going to stalk her. I've been staring at her outside her window, mom. She likes Pantene Pro V. Do you like Pantene Pro V, mom? I want to buy it. I want to smell it. You know, that sort of,
you know,
creepiness.
Maybe he didn't have the capability. It sounds like I'm defending Koberger. Stop me. I'm not.
We know you're a pro burger.
No, I'm not. I'm honest to God, I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I'm, again, doing more reading on this. He does not connect with other people on an emotional level. He does not know how. And not that he couldn't learn, but I think it's really difficult. And I just don't think he had the fostering environment for that to occur. So he doesn't relate to people. He makes people feel very uncomfortable with the interactions. And I just don't think he has a lot of friends. So mom's always going to be there.
He doesn't know how to navigate people.
Right.
That's his thing. That's a very hard thing with autism too, because you don't naturally know how to do it. So it's like a lot of learned type behavior, but he doesn't seem to value that lesson. And if he doesn't value that lesson, he just continues to hit his head against a brick wall, never going, maybe that's a lesson I should pick up on because it might help me get from point A to point B. But he's always just like hitting up against the wall. I don't know why nobody wants to talk. Like, well, that's you. Another interesting piece of that reporting about those letters beyond the the reporting that he was talking about with his mom and that letter that she sent to him. He sent some letters to Washington State University around that same time at his teaching assistantship was in jeopardy. He responded not with one, but two very different letters. The first letter was very groveling. He begged to keep his position, stressed how much he needed the insurance, emphasized his GPA and his dedication. It was like a pleading type letter. Please keep me. Then a little bit later, sends another one. That one flipped. It went after a female professor directly in it. It laid out why she was wrong and he was right. No humility, just pure arrogance in that one, like Jekyll and Hyde, depending on who he knew was going to be looking at this letter. And specifically, we see his anger towards a female erupting again. It's the same personality that we've heard described by his colleagues. I mean, he's late to classes with female professors, never the male ones. He's rating female students horribly, ignoring the men, dismissing women, but showing deference when he wanted something. And his best buddy appears to be a woman, his mom, his attorneys, all female. What the hell does that say about Brian Koberger?
I wonder if he saw them as female, though. I wonder if he was able to strip out their gender, that other women that he didn't need or know, they were women, but the ones that were close to him or that he desperately needed, like a professor, like a mom, they weren't women to him. Does that make sense?
Like he just categorizes everyone differently. But the people who are below him in his mind, below in intelligence, if that's how he scales everything, they're women.
Yes.
But if there's an intelligent woman next to him,
she's different.
She's something else. Or
putting things into those compartments that he needs to be able to relate to them because it's so uncomfortable.
You open this door, he respects him. He loves his mom. He trusts his mom. He trusts these attorneys. And shut that one, open this door over here, and they're pieces of meat and can't be trusted. And it's pulling the doors back in all these different bizarre ways that Koberger does.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.